Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the top of the week podcast from the editors of the magazine that is allegedly pulling the puppet strings over at the editorial page of the New York Times. I am Matt Welch, joined, as is the ancient custom, by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Morning, friendlies.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
We are going to get to the latest in wars, both actual and cultural, here in a moment. But first, a word from our friends at Donors Trust, the principled, tax-friendly way to simplify your charitable giving. Did you know that starting a charitable investment account is as simple as opening a checking or brokerage account? More Americans are discovering this financial tool, known as a donor-advised fund, to maximize potential tax benefits and give money to the causes they love. Donors Trust is unique in this field. It serves charitable givers who love our Constitution and the freedoms that glorious Liberty document protects. It is the oldest and largest donor-advised fund committed to those principles. Do you want to partner with an organization that honors your values, helps streamline and grow your impact, and also connects you with charities promoting individual freedom, personal responsibility, and free markets? If so, go to www.donorstrust.org/reason to download the prospectus and discover whether a donor-advised fund is right for you. That's www.donorstrust.org/reason to find out how you can make a greater impact with your giving. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. You think there would be plenty of other things these days for journalists to argue about and call attention to, like, I don't know, maybe the 10 million Ukrainians who've had to flee their homes under bombardment over the past month. But I swear to God, even Nick Gillespie's dead God, that we are on day four of lefty and or prestige media types being super duper mad online about the fact that the New York Times published an unsigned editorial under the headline "America Has a Free Speech Problem," in which the gray lady dared to suggest that part of said problem is emanating from the political left. NPR's Adam Davidson, a broadcaster of some note, has been the lead hysteric on Team Outrage, saying that he would resign if he worked at the Times. I like that as a threat.
That's like Daffy Duck saying, you know, to Donald Duck, if I wasn't dead, to Bugs Bunny, if I wasn't dead, I would really kill you. You know, it's like,
exactly
what
right.
What does it even mean? What does it even mean?
He also clowned himself over the weekend by daring people to cite even one example of anyone ever getting fired because of cancel culture. They never can. What's particularly weird is that this argument over whether the left has a free speech problem has happening at the exact same time that the New York Times and a bunch of other publications have kind of belatedly admitted that the New York Post's pre-election Hunter Biden laptop story that the social media companies kiboshed fall of 2020. And that elite journalists back in the day poo-pooed as possible Russian disinformation is now, well, yeah, it was his laptop after all. It being the four-day controversy, comes right after there was just an ugly and stupid shout down by a mob of Yale law students over a perfectly normal and boring free speech debate, or what would have been if they would have allowed it to happen. Meanwhile, there's a bunch of laws being passed on the state and local level coming from the right side of the political spectrum that would limit the speech of professors and teachers and the like. Catherine, I'm going to ask you the meta question up first. What does it tell us that people are still at this late date getting riled up about the "is there or is there not cancel culture" question?
I think it tells us that some people really, really want there to not be cancel culture. Because if there is, that presents some real existential problems for people who identify as liberals, I think. And so it would be easiest if maybe this thing didn't exist at all. It's just a kind of like way of squaring a circle, and it's not going to work because this thing definitely does exist. And the particular genealogy of cancel culture, in which it originates on campuses and then bleeds into commercial life and kind of regular adult life in a way that for many, many years, the it doesn't exist people, a variation of the it doesn't exist claim was, okay, it does exist, but it's just these children on college campuses. And when they grow up, they will forget about it. And I think, you know, that has been fairly definitively disproven at this point. But I think people really struggle with
because the children never
it's
grow
Peter
up.
Peter Pan out here. No, I think people really struggle with the distinction between is this thing poorly defined? Clearly it is. It's really actually very hard to do a highly functional version of a definition of cancel culture.
It's like the metaverse.
The conversation forward. But just because we are struggling to define this cluster of phenomena does not mean that it doesn't exist. And I think it's weird that people, especially journalists, whose job is often to kind of collect up a bunch of anecdotes and then some polling data and say, we think there might be something here. Let's discuss, are refusing to do that in this case.
About that, Nick, like, do you get the impression that this has sort of become similar to questions having to do with abortion or gun rights in the following way? Like, event happens. So a large shooting or a law passed in some state that's severely restricting abortion. Everybody goes to their trenches. And in fact, they make sure that their side is going to the trenches. And that is the more important imperative than actually talking about whatever it is in the existing piece of news.
No, I don't think it's like that, to be honest, because those people are at least admitting, you know, like anti-abortion people are like, no, we are passing these laws in order to get rid of abortion. And pro-choice people or pro-abortion people are saying you're passing these laws to get rid of abortion. I think those and even the gun rights things are more open and honest debates because, you know, and increasingly with gun stuff, it's, you know, what can we do to reduce the, you know, this happening? But it's you're not questioning whether or not it's happening. You know, you quoted Adam Davidson there were, you know, a bunch of other people over the weekend, you know, who were essentially saying, no, this does not exist. You know, this is the problem with no name or something like that, or it's not a problem and you can't even define it. And then when people define it, they're like, no, that's not really a definition. Or then when they say, give me five examples, and you give them five examples and they say, no, those aren't examples. I think the debate over cancel culture, while imprecise, as Catherine was talking about, the debate over whether it exists is so fundamentally fake and false and in bad faith that's what bugs the hell out of people, that the failing New York Times, which is, you know, a centrist liberal looking to the left, you know, outlet, finally admitting it. It's like, okay, now we have to, you know, we have to actually either acknowledge it or really go nuclear and try and say, no, this is absolutely false. You know, and the New York Times is being captured once again by Tom Cotton and, you know, the other people who run the op-ed page.
Peter, part of the debate about this tends to kind of bring up or highlight the age-old debate, which we had in the pages of Reason between Ken White of Pope Hat and Ken White of Pope Hat, sure. And
Pope Hat's
and Greg
Ken
Fire
White.
Of Lukiana.
Yeah.
about whether there is such a thing as the culture of free speech and whether we should be worried about it. I would posit that Reason, generally speaking, and the three of us probably, although maybe me and Nick a little bit more.
The three of us? Which yeah, one of us is missing?
Who is the, who's
we'll
being
let our
excluded?
Listeners
obviously,
decide
you and
who's
Peter,
been excluded.
Yeah, it's, up, it's either me or Catherine just got cut loose.
Not that, you. It's
that
not
can't
you.
Count.
Anywho, yeah. Culture of free speech, right? So I bring that up because you, Peter, who I'm erasing, even by asking this question, have usually been the one who, in the context of big tech companies making decisions like, I don't know, blocking the New York Post's Twitter account for a week over publishing the Hunter Biden story, which turned out to be at least, you know, kind of true. Whether or not it was important is another thing. You've defended that on, hey, look, it's private free speech rights. That's part of, you know, the free associations. That's OK. Does not.
It's what Alexander Hamilton would have wanted, Matt.
Yes. Thank you. 195 years of effed up news. How do you square, Peter, in your own brain, your defense of those of the importance of private company exercise of speech policies, ideas, with the sense that I think is pretty widely shared among some of us here, that the culture of free speech is being degraded?
This is a good question, and I was thinking about this over the weekend during a Slack conversation with Brian Doherty that went back to, I believe it was 2015, when we were so innocent, when the words cancel culture didn't really exist, or at least didn't exist in the popular consciousness the way they do now. And there was what you might describe as a proto-cancel culture debate over a Batgirl variant comic book cover. And I wrote about
this. He's not lying, people.
Nick Gillespie, our colleague here, wrote about this. Brian Doherty wrote about this.
Now I'm no longer part of this podcast. I think I was raised.
And he wasn't young. I just want to point out.
I was younger, man. Actually, I was older then.
And at the time, what it sort of seemed like was this was a productive and in some ways positive, or at least what it seemed like to me, and I think in some ways to Nick as well, though Nick, you know, should clarify if I've gotten his position wrong, but was that there was something positive about the fact that a bunch of people complained about this variant cover which showed Joker with a knife to Batgirl's throat. It was referencing a classic moment from Batman comics, and that ends with Joker crippling and by implication raping Batwoman. This happened in the 1980s, but it's been sort of a part of the canon since then. And this was a way for sort of people who didn't have power to speak back and to speak out. And I think that there's something true about that, right? Like Twitter empowers people who previously did not have the ability to respond to major corporations and to pundits with platforms. And it's not just Twitter. Twitter's sort of the specific example, but the internet at large does this, right? It empowers voices that weren't heard before, and I think there's something that's good and positive about that. At the same time, the pendulum has clearly swung in a direction that I am not particularly comfortable with. And I look back, and I basically defended DC Comics' decision to pull that cover. The artist, you know, had said, "Wait, I think this is the right decision." You know, after hearing from the fans, even I don't want this to be sold. But I look back, and I read Brian Doherty's piece, and he was much less comfortable with this, and he made the argument that, look,
that Batgirl I was asking for it.
He made the argument that. Not that. Not at all. There was no clear libertarian, like there was no rigorous libertarian principle at stake here, right? Like obviously DC Comics in a perfect libertarian universe has the right to pull this cover. And obviously fans or critics have the right to complain on Twitter about this. And then you just negotiate that sort of thing between the fans, between the buyers, essentially, and the speaker, you know, the observers and the company. But he said he felt like we were entering a possible world in which speech and art and expression that isn't, just could be squelched by a very small group of people at any time. And I think we have, like 7 years later, we have gotten there. And it is not one that I am super comfortable with. And I think going back to this, you know, in some ways, look, you can understand why somebody might be, might even be upset by a cover like that, because in some ways it's sort of, there is a sense in which that cover glamorizes a kind of horrific and violent act in comics history. But all of this goes back to, like, sort of at root is predicated on something that I think is just a misunderstanding of free speech and what it's there for, which is that people, especially young people, increasingly don't want to allow speech that they don't like, that they find offensive, or in the parlance of our times, that they find hurtful. And that's part and parcel with the effort to define speech as violence. We saw this when the editor of the New York Times op-ed page, James Bennett, was removed a couple of years ago. The tweets that, you know, that went around all sort of said, I think this puts Black staffers on the New York Times, I think this puts them in danger, right? It was a way to suggest that the publication of an op-ed by Tom Cotton was physically dangerous in some sense, right? And so there is just this idea that speech is a kind of violence, and therefore that free speech rules don't apply to that speech. But that just gets far too widely applied, I think, and is almost always just like a bad idea to sort of conflate these two things. I mean, the point of free speech is to defend ideas that are offensive and that are awful. And I would just sort of like, the easy thing you can pick here is to defend like the right to speak Nazi ideology. And I think everybody here would agree that Nazi ideology has produced an awful lot of violence, of truly horrific, horrific acts over the last 100 years, right? Many people are dead because of that.
I'm going to need to see some documentation of that.
And yet the whole point is the whole point here is that free speech is supposed to defend those ideas, the expression of the ideas, and that the expression of ideas is not dangerous and it is not violence and it is not the same thing. And people have just lost that and started to conflate these two things.
I think that's an excellent set of points to hammer on. While you were talking, Peter, I went back because I literally had no memory of this, and I realized that my memory implants are kind of not working as well as they should anymore. But I looked at the column I wrote about this for the Daily Beast, and what I stressed in that was, and I think this is still true, and I think this is a very good aspect of what often gets called cancel culture, is that audiences, whether they're individuals or groups of people, feel empowered to speak back to producers, creators, artists, whatever. And this is a theme I've harped on for at least 20 years, that there's a general flattening between the artist or the producer of stuff and the consumers and the audience of things. And I think that's great that everybody who's creating stuff is getting more real-time feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, from the audience. And artists increasingly have to explain themselves to audiences in ways that they didn't bother to or they didn't have to in the past. I think that's generally, a very good thing. And it's not going away. I also think there's an aspect of cancel culture that is legitimate, where there are more people and more voices and more perspectives in the conversation, or in every conversation now. And that's kind of great. I love it every time, somebody like Bill Cosby starts a Twitter thread, in anticipation of his comeback special on Netflix or whatever, and says like, hey, what's your favorite sweater I wore on the Cosby Show? And then like immediately gets bombarded with people putting in memes about what a sexual criminal he is and a horrible human being, to the degree that his comeback doesn't happen. These are good things. These are leveling things. These are, I think, ultimately libertarian and kind of free market, deregulated speech things. And then where we're at now, though, and to your point, Peter, like that argument that Black staffers are literally in danger because of a Tom Cotton op-ed is insane. And I think people should voice that if they believe that. And then what we need to have is a robust conversation about all of that. And that, Matt, this is where the culture of free speech comes in, that you don't immediately stop conversations, arguments, pile-ons, the minute that some group or a representative of a real or imagined group gets to say, okay, now I get the last word on this because of X, Y, or Z reason. And this is where the cancel culture debate has started to go. And it's not anything legal. I mean, we'll talk about the gag order laws about teaching things in a bit, I'm sure. But corporate America has caved so badly to any tremor of pushback. Schools have done this, colleges and universities, et cetera. And we need to, invigorate the culture of free speech, so these arguments last until they are played out, not just when, a particular person weighs in and then it's like, okay, well, we're not going to talk about this anymore.
I think one of the arguments we've seen is that there's too much feedback, but I would actually just ask a question of the group here. I don't think there's too much feedback, but I sometimes think that big organizations have decided to overweight the feedback from relatively small groups online. And it seems like, to me, like the problem isn't that there's too much opportunity to speak back. It's that for various reasons, large organizations that sort of that publish expression have decided, wait a minute, very small groups of people, we're gonna bend to their wishes rather than just sort of continue to do what it is that we want to do.
Catherine, I think I almost heard Nick valorizing comments sections. So I just want to give you an opportunity.
I missed the comment sections. I don't read them anymore, but you know, they got,
well, that's kind of an issue.
We're the last, one of the last believers in comment section.
Believers or just a little bit slow to kill them. Anyways, I wasn't asking you about that, Catherine, because that would be rude. But in Nick's spirit of, hey, you know, this side of the argument does have a point, or there is some possible good over here. What are the Adam Davidsons of the world, or at least the people who critique the notion of a cancel culture as it is, you know, widely described once every 6 weeks in the pages of the Atlantic magazine? What do they write about? What can we learn from their critiques, even if we disagree with their overall broad thrust?
Someone want to define what an Adam Davidson is?
Nope.
Well, I mean, we did earlier in this podcast, and we said he's a prominent broadcaster and Twitterer. We'll say that. So he, you know, I think he's doing a thing which has been a legitimate thing to do through the entire cancel culture discourse, which is to say, hey, y'all should sharpen up your arguments a little bit. If you were going to freak out about this, and y'all are definitely freaking out, I want you to be really clear about what you think the problem is. And that is an absolutely legitimate thing to do. In fact, it is exactly the sort of thing that defenders of free speech are often pointing at when they say, this is the important dynamic. Like, people have to say stuff that other people think is wrong. They have to be allowed to say stuff that other people think is wrong, so that then there can be this back and forth, which allows the sharpening of arguments. Like, that's like the whole point, man. And so I think that's always a valuable service. And I think, you know, the New York Times op-ed, which we were talking about, or rather editorial, which we were talking about, which was ghostwritten by Robbie Suave, according to the internet, you know, I thought it was great. I thought it was really, really good, except the first sentence was wrong. And, you know, that, so at the very, very beginning of the piece, they say, they define the kind of the problem. And they say, for all the tolerance and enlightenment that modern society claims, Americans are losing hold of a fundamental right as citizens of a free country, the right to speak their minds and voice their opinions in public without fear of being shamed or shunned. And that's not the right. The right is not to not be scared of being shamed or shunned. The right is to voice your opinion. And we could also, as we have many, many times on this podcast, say, okay, well, there are your free speech rights in the United States as a citizen of the United States protected by the First Amendment. And then there's a bunch of other stuff that we also care about. And that is the culture of free speech. That is pluralism. That is toleration. That is, you know, due process. It's, you know, having a robust discourse. And those are all a little different from your rights. And unfortunately, that first sentence of that piece gave a certain critic of the idea of cancel culture a real foothold to say that this whole thing was wrong and bad. I think that was a misstatement of what rights we have. I do think, though, that stuff like the Davidson thread where he says, hey, let's interrogate this. Let's. Of course, at the end of the whole process, he says, like, yes, I see that you provided me all these examples and also many definitions from which we could work. And then he mostly said, like, okay, I now grant that there are perhaps a few dozen examples of this, which I think is still off by a couple orders of magnitude. But, you know, I think he, unlike many, I do think he was at least trying to do the forms of rational discourse, which I think are very important to defend and which are not honored when we get something like the shout down at the Yale Law School.
Nick, because you flagged it and because we should talk about it before we pivot to video,
I've been pivoting to video since 2007.
I'm pivoting to the metaverse. Have.
Trail.
I'm the last I was the only successful pivot to video.
That could be true.
Yeah.
I'm going to search pivoted my like, heart for exception you to know, that rule.
Like Cal Ripken on a double play, Matt Welch.
Yeah. Anywho, you referenced the the passage of laws that in the name of kind of pushing back.
In the name of love, Matt Welch.
Pushing back against the censorious overlords to kind of limit what can be or how certain topics can be broached in K through 12 schools and occasionally even in universities.
Colleges, yeah. So-called colleges and universities, Matt Welch.
For recognizing my pain. What is wrong with those laws? What are the people who support them getting wrong?
You know, the main thing, first off, a bunch of them, these are at the state level. PEN America has a constantly updated database of these. There are hundreds of pieces of legislation over the past year and a half or 2 years that have been introduced. Some are being enacted. There are, you know, dozens of them that specifically ban the use of the 1619 Project in any government-funded school. I think that's really fucked up. Like, I don't think it's the job of, you know, a legislature to say you can or cannot teach this particular book. That seems scary. Other ones even more ban the teaching of CRT, which is critical race theory, which is normally not particularly well defined in these laws. I went through a couple of, you know, several of them a while ago. And, you know, this from a purely operational point of view, you don't want the state to be dictating what can and cannot be said in schools. And you can say, oh, well, they're public schools. They take public money, so they got to pay the tune. We don't think that, libertarians don't think that in any other circumstance, right? We don't say, well, you know, colleges get federally guaranteed loans, so they have to follow all of the federal laws, blah, blah, blah. Like this, we push back against that. So I think it's dangerous when you allow the state at the top level to start dictating what is and is not allowed. You get into, you know, and where this comes up mostly is in, you know, every state with the quite possibly the exception of New Jersey, where I grew up. I don't remember ever having a New Jersey history class, but I know everybody who goes to school in Virginia or Texas or, you know, New York, they do, you know, they're proud of their state in a way. I guess New Jersey is kind of ashamed of it. But, you know, they're going to set certain kinds of parameters on those things. But this seems to be actually creating laws that ban the articulation of certain concepts or so condition them where you cannot talk about historical events in a way that will make certain people feel bad or are divisive. It's like, if you don't want to teach slavery, just say you're not going to teach slavery. If you don't want to teach in a health class anything about, you know, lesbian and gays, just say that. But this type of overly broad attempts to control speech in the name of civic unity and blah, 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 is really, I think it's a disaster.
So I will say the just say you're not going to teach the thing approach absolutely has to be paired with school choice, or else it's we're doomed.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, if we are genuinely putting kids into zoned public schools with no other options, then what you're describing is a problem. And I think that
we are doing. Yeah, and I agree. School choice is the way around. Not the arguments we will have about differing visions of the American founding and the meaning of America, but it will change the debate so that you actual students and parents of students aren't screwed over.
And I think the tricky part about this is, you know, it is equally fair to accuse particularly Republicans right now of being hypocritical when they simultaneously advocate school choice and also advocate, you know, the widespread banning of certain books or terms in public school curriculum. But they also, you know, in some ways, at least, are being consistent in if they would then actually open up school choice to a diversity of curricular arguments. Now, that is not the way that these bills are currently structured. There is, in theory, a way you could do it. But that is absolutely not where we are right now.
And I think it's also really important. This goes to, you know, this is also the difference between the Adam Davidsons of the world saying, oh, you know, or, you know, or people at the New York Times. And I think the New York Times treated James Bennett, you know, ridiculously badly. But it's one thing for readers of a publication and employees of a publication to say, you know what, this fucking guy, I hated the op-ed that he commissioned and he should be fired. That's different than a state legislature and government, you know, governor saying, if you use these words, you will be fined or you will be punished. And most of these state level bans, these gag orders have some kind of punishment involved. And, you know, we make a distinction between state power and private power. And we do that for a reason. And it is worse, objectively, when the state starts saying, you know what, you can't talk about slavery in these terms. You can't ever even mention the 1619 Project. You know, what is fucking wrong with people?
I'd just add that implicit in some of those laws, especially the so-called don't say gay laws, is just the idea that teaching certain things is dangerous to children. And it is a similar conflation of ideas and harm.
Okay. We're going to get to our weekly listener email of the week. That's not redundant. In a moment here. But first, are you stressed out? Temper shorter than usual? Feeling strain in key relationships? Maybe you could use the chance to talk to an impartial observer? Unload a little bit? Well, check out betterhelp.com/roundtable. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. Unload the stressors. Get some unbiased feedback. Be pretty surprised at what you might gain from the process. See if it's for you. Reason Roundtable listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp. So let me spell out how you go and do that. It's BETTERHELP.com/roundtable. Get started with the great unburdening. Visit BetterHelp.com today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder, send your email questions of the week to roundtable@reason.com. This admirably succinct query comes from Ben W., who writes, who do you think was the best post-war president? And then, P.S., is the Western the ultimate libertarian genre? Catherine, I'm just guessing that your happy place is going to be more about libertarian genres than it is about good presidents, but I will let you go
first. I feel seen, Matt. Thank you for that. I'm not a big fan of the Western, though I understand why libertarians like them. Of course, my exception to that policy is every libertarian's favorite space Western, Firefly. Yes, I know it's a cliche, and Nick was primed for a grunt. But
you know, in space, nobody can hear me sigh.
Yeah, we will be pushing you out of the airlock soon as we possibly can. But until that day, we should rewatch Firefly and enjoy it. You know, I actually gave this question some thought because, as Matt rightly notes, my initial impulse was like, impeach them all. You know, I hate everyone. And I was tempted toward a, you know, what one of you may yet indulge in, which is the sort of libertarian contrarian take of like Jimmy Carter, everybody's fave, actually deregulated the thing,
Gerald
and whatever.
Ford.
But I kind of have to go Ronald Reagan here. I'm just going to do it. I'm just going to say it. You know, now more than ever, maybe being really worried about Russia was wise. And yes, he spent way too much money on defense. And yes, he ultimately betrayed his libertarian principles, and yes, maybe he was not nice to the gays, and like yes, yes, yes to all those things.
You're really making a strong case.
But
also blew up the deficit.
And yep, but you know, the framework with which he approached the presidency, his rhetoric, his influence, I think in retrospect, salutary on the conservative movement. Like, we now see what the conservative movement looks like untethered from Reagan, and it's not great, y'all. For all of those things, I'm going to give the title to Ronnie Reagan.
You can take the gal out of the Weekly Standard.
So unfair.
Nick, I know, but it's fun. Nick, what say you?
One, about the genre. I like Westerns a lot. I don't think they're particularly libertarian. And, you know, there's for every kind of libertarian one, which is either people on the frontier banding together to fend off war, or the obverse of that with something like the outlaw Josie Wales. There's horrible communitarian stories, you know, that are Westerns. And I highly recommend people look at The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which are both horrible movies and are, you know, are in the sense the messages that they convey. I will put in a note for Bonanza, the massively long-running TV series. What's interesting about that, and this is something Abney Schles really hits on in her History of the Great Society, which came out 4 or 5 years ago and is well worth reading, where she, but she points out that Bonanza is the first Western that is set after the frontier has kind of been tamed. And what it's actually about is how do you distribute a bountiful, you know, the bounty of a thriving economy. And it's kind of interesting because instead of trying to establish the kind of safety perimeter, it's about what happens after the society, the new society, the new world has kind of been created and is functioning. And there's a lot of problems, you know, because people get jealous, people are envious, some people are cut out. There's a lot of thieving and war and stuff like that. So I'd say that about that. But I love Westerns. I just don't think they're particularly libertarian.
Don't wiggle out of the president question. Thank you.
Yeah, in terms of the president question, I gave this a lot of thought because once many, many eons ago, I was on Freedom Watch with Judge Napolitano on President's Day. And he was like, Nikki, who's your favorite president? I was like, none of them. You know, and I mean that. I really have no favorites. But if we're talking post-war presidents, in a serious way, I think Eisenhower deserves a longer look than he normally gets. He fiscally was very prudent. He balanced the budgets and things like that. He also diplomatically maneuvered, you know, one of the most volatile periods of the Cold War. And actually, without getting entailed in a lot of dumb things, which came later under Kennedy and LBJ, but he also did not allow, generally speaking, he did not make the communists think that they were going to have free run of the globe and things like that. He was decent on civil rights, not great, but I was thinking more in terms of foreign policy. He actually, there's a lot to learn from Eisenhower there, but I hold up to the idea that none of them is still the right answer.
So on the Westerns question, I'll just say that Westerns at their best are about the contingency of law and governance because they show American life and society, typically, in its primordial unformed state where law is custom rather than this kind of bureaucratic monstrosity we have everywhere today. And so in that sense, it can do things that are libertarian, that is harder in other genres, with the maybe exception of science fiction, especially science fiction about the frontier. In some ways, I don't have super strong opinions about the president question, but as I was thinking about this, there was some research that came out that found that most people's favorite pop music came out around the time they were 13 or 14 years old, and that most people stop listening to new music around the age of 25, right? And it's obviously not because the music that came out when you were 13 or 14 is necessarily better than any other pop music. Instead, there's something about the pop music of that time in your life that sticks with you. It's not just formative, although it is. It's also idyllic and nostalgic and sort of exciting. The world was still new and fresh, and yet you were also like just barely, you know, formed enough to understand it. And you kind of wish at times you could go back to that era, and the music transports you. And so, of course, I feel the same way about presidents, and that means for me it's Bill Clinton, who there's so many things you could criticize about him, and yet He worked with Republicans to pass welfare reform. He reduced the budget deficit. He let government spending decline as a share of GDP. And he kind of understood that macro mega initiatives from the White House were a bad idea. Now, there were a lot of terrible culture wars that President Clinton participated in and in some cases caused himself. This was, you know, the era of hearings about Marilyn Manson and video games and Reservoir Dogs and all of that stuff. And it wasn't necessarily that Clinton himself was pushing that stuff, but that was sort of a lot of what consumed society. And yet, there's something to say. There's something to say about a culture in which those are the problems that people have time to focus on, because you know we're no longer concerned about nuclear war, and the federal government isn't trying to pass pass trillion-dollar bills every other week. And like, so instead people just get bound up in like petty stuff about baseball and Marilyn Manson. And not to say those things are good. I complain about those hearings all the time. But there is Bill Clinton is my the pop music of my 14-year-old life, and I kind of have a fondness for his presidency.
I think that the pop music rule for presidents might work better as not being like 13 to 14, but like negative 10. you don't have the memory of how.
What does that mean?
Means the president who was presidenting 10 years before you were born looks a lot better because you don't remember him. You don't really have any anchor to him whatsoever. Like I, the first president I remember was probably Gerald Ford. And so that means I just remember Chevy Chase. And then it's just kind of been,
Catherine, does Nixon look great to you? Nice.
Yeah, I was going to say that rule seems to apply differentially depending on when you were born.
I don't know. You were quoting Now More Than Ever. That was Nixon.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I definitely was raised in a household where like my earliest political awareness for sure was my parents making jokes about how Ronald Reagan thought ketchup was a vegetable. So that's where
I missed the bedtime for Bonzo.
Oh my God.
Jokes.
Oh, the God, yeah. Huge part Bonzo of my childhood. Did my dad like scatter us off to bed shouting bedtime for Bonzos? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Really?
One of the best Ramon songs.
That is why I will join Nick. I will have a concurring opinion about Ike.
Oh, my
Ike.
God. I take it back.
Yeah, I was going to say, it was going to make you feel bad, but it's too late for me to, you don't want to, don't change the horses midstream, Catherine. You just don't do that. For similar reasons, I would append to Nick's correct opinion about Eisenhower's relative or comparative restraint, which is different than what he campaigned on. He campaigned on rollback of communist aggression, which was widespread in the world in the early 1950s. And when the crackdown came in Budapest in 1956, he didn't do anything really, except, and it wasn't just Budapest, it was in East Germany and Poland in 1953 as well. And he kind of sat on his hands, which turned out to be the right thing to do. Hawks were furious at him. This was fodder for the John Birch Society to call him a traitor.
Well, he revealed himself as a witting dupe of the Soviet Union, right? Like an
correct.
Active communist.
But at the same time that he was doing those admirable things, he also unleashed in 1957 the Eisenhower Doctrine, which basically put America in a position of being the new kind of colonial overseer of the Middle East, or at least a military right of meddling in your affairs. And that, I think, history will not look as kindly upon. But mostly it's ignorance. I wasn't around, so he looks good to me. My general theory about presidents is that they only look good after in the rearview mirror, which, you know, the prediction that I made that was howled at the time is that there was going to be people who missed George W. Bush. At the time that he left office, he had an approval rating of like 12% or something. And Nick Gillespie was writing furious and great pieces for The Wall Street Journal talking about what a big government disaster George W. Bush had been. And yet people, they kind of like him a little bit now, not his presidency, but like him. Anyways, as we know, the ultimate libertarian genre is baseball sabermetrics books. It's not even a contest, people. Come on, think about it.
Does that mean Moneyball is the ultimate libertarian movie?
It's up there. It has some timeless insights Nick, which is one is put Brad Pitt in your movie. No one's unhappy.
Fat Jonah, what's his name, is better than
I just went to
Joe.
Sleep and then woke back up. But the words Brad Pitt just woke me back up. I was like, what are we talking about?
It was like a defibrillator.
There are a lot of great things about that movie, especially the backstory, where at one point Steven Soderbergh was going to direct it, and cartoon versions of Bill, what's his face, the sabermetrics guy? Bill James. Cartoon versions of him were going to show up and sit on the main character's shoulder and explain sabermetrics to the audience at one point. And then the producers were like, that seems, we shouldn't do that.
We really,
but the movie that they ended up
there.
Making is great because it's because it ends up being a romantic take on an essentially unromantic view of the world, right? The movie's view of the world is actually we shouldn't just go with our gut. What we should do is run the numbers and see what makes sense. And the movie ends up somehow or another taking that idea and making it into a romantic idea about how to play baseball better.
I liked it because it was a stinging rebuke to every little league grammar school and high school coach I ever had who were just fat jerk-offs talking about mythology and snapping your jockstrap. And that movie
are those
was
the
like,
same
no,
thing?
Your time is over, you guys. And we're playing a different game now.
There is a romance, as Matt Welch once wrote in the pages of Reason magazine, of watching ideas win, Nick Gillespie. Let us go to our end of show cultural consumption in addition to Moneyball. Although I just want to add that, Billy Beane inherited some really good players, and they're the ones who made them win.
I think it gets played down a bit. The Giambi brothers, you know, they're the real Bash brothers, right?
Bash and all the steroids.
All right, so
what have we been consuming to pleasure our consumable bits? I don't know what that means. Catherine, help me.
I actually, on the theme of presidents, I guess, I went back to a podcast that I had liked and then totally forgotten about. And my podcast app somehow was like, hey, remember this podcast you like? So thank you, algorithms, for this gift. But the podcast My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, which has been around for ages, I think since about 2006. And it's just what it sounds like. It's sort of history lessons that are in some way relevant to current events. And the tone is very much kind of poor man's hardcore history. And I don't say that as a criticism of Bruce Carlson, who is the host and voice of most of My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, but as praise. The production values are just lower, but it has the same kind of one guy dramatically narrates history vibes. I listened to a recent one that was about the end of the Coolidge presidency after the death of his son from a minor infection a mere 4 years before the discovery of penicillin. Just a really good episode. And I noticed this podcast also had taken a bunch of heat for an episode that he did on the anniversary of January 6th about the history of violence and disruption and activism in the U.S. Capitol. And it was a really good episode. I listened to it. It was a really good episode. And a bunch of people were like, you're normalizing January 6th and the events of January 6th and how dare you? And they're mad about it. And I think, you know, the whole point of studying history is to get perspective on current events. And I certainly find myself, as I am editing Reason's very own print magazine, having an increased desire to use history to understand the present, because the present seems chaotic and new and bad, and history is a good way to sort out your brain. My History Can Beat Up Your Politics. Very good podcast, kind of old school, not so flashy, but I recommend it to fans of hardcore history or people who are tired of podcasts like this one, where we kind of chatty chat about the news and want a little bit more to anchor their consumption in some facts.
Speaking of bonus armies, Peter, what have you been consuming?
I read No One Will Miss Her, a delightfully twisty mystery thriller by Reason contributor Kat Rosenfield, came out last year. I liked it for a bunch of reasons. It is extremely well-paced and engaging and smartly plotted. It's also psychologically insightful, especially about the relationships between men and women and the relationship between people and the places they come from. But the thing I liked most about this book is that despite some cinematic structure and pacing, it does some things that only books, only written fiction can do in terms of perspective and getting inside the characters' heads. And too many commercial novels these days are really just movies in book form and designed to be sold and adapted into movies. And while I think you could make a great movie out of this, Rosenfield manages to transcend that somewhat reductive model of what popular commercial fiction can and should be. It's a great read. Highly recommend it to everyone.
And highly recommend her journalism for Reason, which is always on point. Speaking of which, Nick, what have you?
And her recent podcast on the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie.
Thank you.
Very nice Kat Rosenfield discussion about her story about the Matrix and the prolonged cultural power of the Matrix. I am also going to recommend a podcast, not my own, which I do anyway, but Ask a Jew. I was recently invited to be on a podcast that comes from Paloma Media, which some of you know Matt is connected with. It's Ask a Jew. It's hosted by Chaya Leah Safran and Yael.
Go ahead, Nick. You can do it.
Barter. No, I can't. I know their first names and I don't know how to pronounce their last names. I have no idea why they wanted to interview me because I'm not Jewish.
Wow, a little defensive.
And
there.
I am not going to be, I don't think I'm a prime candidate for conversion. But Ask a Jew, we talked about everything. They were particularly interested in my teen magazine past, and they wanted to ask a lot of questions about the Twa Corys, Corey Haim and Corey Feldman. And we ran through that as well as my PhD dissertation chapter on The Great Gatsby, my days at Teen Machine, Mel Gibson as the world's sexiest anti-Semite. And it really, you know, it's like 2 hours long. It's a great episode in a great podcast. And then I end with trying to explain to them who Barabbas was, because they're not particularly conversant in the New Testament. But Barabbas is the thief and murderer and rapist who is sprung instead of Jesus in the Gospels. And then he is left to ponder his, you know, his undeserved grace and his a chance at a second life, which becomes the subject of a fantastic novel by Par Lagervis called Barabbas. And it's a great conversation. They are extremely funny and insightful. And Chaya is in an Orthodox community in Long Beach, so she is both super American and yet living a lifestyle by choice that is very atypical of contemporary America. And Yael is a Israeli who emigrated here and worked with the NYPD in their public affairs and is a crisis PR manager now. And they have a fantastic kind of take on America and what matters and what doesn't. So Ask a Jew, if you Google, I mean, it's in the show notes, but Google Ask a Jew podcast and check out the latest episode with me, but run through the whole goddamn thing. It's great.
I would also add that Hialeah is throws yeah. a
see I don't
I mean I probably pronounced I, it wrong I mean
I know I think you're right
host the best damn Shabbat dinner that you're ever gonna have. It could be that I haven't been to a lot of Shabbat dinners compared to other people on this podcast, but I attended one recently at her house in the LBC, the nice part of my hometown, I might add. Just crazy and wonderful. I'm pretty sure Yael was on psychedelics while we were there. And it was like 20 people, all just crazy. Iowa Hawk showed up at some point. So like it was just spot on in an Orthodox household.
So it's like the cantina band, you know, the Star Wars cantina for Sabbath.
It was fantastic and generous and open-hearted. And like truly insanely tolerant in a way that kind of only America and a couple of weird pockets of the globe can ever hope to replicate. Speaking of America, what? My recommendation is the YouTube channel of Kyle Dunnigan. If you haven't seen Kyle Dunnigan, you probably have, or without knowing it. He used to be the main writer and a performer on the Inside Amy Schumer show. He does a lot of impressions, goes on like Joe Rogan and Adam Carolla and Howard Stern and such. But he has on his YouTube channel, it does like a one weekly show that's like the Kyle Dunnigan show or something like that. But the better one, or the one that I'm recommending in particular, is the Fresh Prez of DC. I hope I'm not overselling it by laughing, thinking about it, but he just does really, really good impressions, and they do this really creepy, like face off kind of technology, right? Where they, it's sort of deep fakey face thing. So it's creepy, and his Biden impersonation, I mean, it's the Fresh Prez of DC. So it's sort of a stumbling Joe Biden going through life, and he's got his little, micro house servants of Ben Shapiro. And then like people show up that just have no business being there. Like, you know, Pete Davidson will walk in, and then there's Caitlyn Jenner, and Hunter Biden. And Vladimir Putin, obviously, all played by Kyle Dunnigan in these horrible face things. And it is so much funnier than any comedy on television. It's painful, and it comes out every week. Really great. Kyle Dunnigan, you spell his last name Dunnigan. And the YouTube channel is Kyle Dunnigan Comedy. But the one that I recommend strongest of his regular recurring bits there is Fresh Prez of DC. All right, we are going to wrap up here. But before we do, I would like to read this advertisement at the end of the show, pointing to a very good opportunity for those of you who are listening who live in a certain region. Are you ready? Hey, New Yorkers and New York adjacents, are you sick and tired of cancel culture and thought police? Looking for live, unfettered, and perhaps unhinged conversations with maverick thinkers? Then come out Monday, April 4th, to see a live taping of... What do you think? What do you think, Nick? The interview with Nick Gillespie. That's right.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Monday, April 4th, featuring Columbia neuroscientist Carl Hart, who's the author of Drug Use for Grownups, Chasing Liberty in the Land of Fear. It's at the Caveat Theater in Manhattan's Lower East Side. All these places are just selected by how short of a walk Nick has from his apartment. It's 21A Clinton Street. The doors open at 6 p.m. There's a bar. Tickets start at the low, low. I think end, too, at the low, low price of $10. This is going to be crucial and great entertainment. In an age when the drug war is being challenged like never before, Carl Hart is breaking bold new ground on how we think about drugs and individual freedom, even copping to his own recreational use of heroin. Nick will have a heart-to-heart talk with a neuroscientist about his path-breaking research and such like. Go to, for more information about this terrific event, go to reason.com/events. See how that works? And this is number two, right, Nick, of your series?
Yes, so what we're calling the Reason Speakeasy series, yeah. Where, you know, it's kind of prohibited, but it's also free thinking and freewheeling.
Prohibited. By who? By
you know,
them?
By them, you know, the cancelers.
By Van Morrison.
The commissars.
People are constantly adding me to try and get you fired, Nick. So I guess in that sense. You are being canceled.
All right.
By there people, are, you, know? You mean?
I mean you, Matt.
Yeah,
I mean, we could just say.
Yes, thank you. I was going to.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, yeah. No need to beat around the bush.
It's in Slack,
about this stuff.
Though. Yeah, that's the twist.
All right. Thank you for listening. Listen to all of our stuff at reason.com/podcasts. Give us money at reason.com. Donate. Or just send Catherine an email talking about who you want to be fired next. Starting with Nick, but then moving on to Peter and then perhaps me. Okay, bye. We'll see you next Monday.